Governor Broughton, you are speaking today to the annual convention of the North Carolina chapters of the New Farmers of America, with a membership of approximately 4,000 farm youth. The New Farmers of America is a national organization of Negro farm youth in vocational agriculture, with a membership of approximately 50,000 who have dedicated themselves to improving the farming methods and living conditions of their race. New Farmers of America, it is my privilege to present to you North Carolina's most influential friend of vocational education, who more than any other individual is responsible for the increased appropriations for vocational education by the 1941 General Assembly, a state appropriation practically double that made by any former legislature, His Excellency J. Melville Broughton, Governor of North Carolina.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. I am very glad indeed to have the privilege of participating in this program honoring the great Booker T. Washington. Hero worshipers always are happy when they find in the youthful lives of their idols some foregleam of the greatness which came in their later years. Booker T. Washington's began with the first paid work that he ever did. A Yankee schoolteacher, as he described her, employed him to do a job of scrubbing. The keen-minded worker knew that what manner of service he must do. From his description of the New Englander, you get the impression that she had all of the New England conscience, plus no special glamour or personal pulchritude. But he did that work so scrupulously that one meticulous maiden from a community which could produce witches if the hunt was aggressive enough was unable to find a speck of dirt remaining. In his childhood, he concluded that work well done would emancipate any person of any race from want. Though he lived through an era in which race agitations reached often their most tragic levels, he always declared that there was not in this country any race problem. He contended with great eloquence that there were personal problems, but he saw in them no racial element. He did not believe in sectional problems, but he did believe in universal problems, all of which were personal. If there was a lynching, he declared that Maine and California would feel its impact, and if poverty, disease, and ignorance existed anywhere in the nation, their evils would be felt everywhere in that nation. Therefore, he preached, if we find the effects of low living standards, we go not to the communities which tolerate them, but to the whole of America. And we may be assured, he said, that this pauperism, these ills, and this ignorance are a cure for nothing. Booker T. Washington disliked among his own people most the professional problem solver. In his commencement address at Livingston College, Salisbury, 35 years ago, he told the story of a brilliant member of his class about whom he had heard nothing since graduation. When finally the two met, Dr. Washington, an international character, and the classmate, an unknown, the educator was shocked to learn that his friend had spent all of his postgraduate days solving the race problem. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Washington said earnestly, don't be a solvum problem. This slip of the tongue he liked, and ever afterward he was against the solvum problems. He elaborated the idea that there was no race problem with rich illustrations from his own experience. First and foremost, in the personal solution of the personal equation, he declared the conscientious execution of one's duty. He did not deny the acuteness of race animosities. He saw too much of it to deny it. But he did contend that skilled workmanship and honest labor would overcome such hostility, and that wherever the Negro performed a service with honesty and efficiency, there would be found an ample demand for it. He was willing to submit to the white South, and in a pragmatic way, the question of the black man's education. When February 12, 1904, he delivered in the Concert Hall of Madison Square Garden in New York City his celebrated address, Negro Education Not a Failure, he observed that several persons holding high official positions had recently said that Negro education does not pay and that all efforts at his education had failed. The southern states, which out of their poverty are contributing rather liberally for the education of all people, he declared, as well as individual and organized philanthropy throughout the country, have a right to know whether the Negro is responding to the efforts that have been made to place him upon a higher plane of civilization. So he took this cause to his own southern people. We must convince the southern white people of the value of educating the Negro, and this we are doing according to the testimony of southern white people themselves, Dr. Washington declared. He sent out letters to representative southern men and received 136 replies. In response to the question whether education has made the Negro a more useful citizen, 121 replied affirmatively, 4 negatively, and 11 made no answer. This was 38 years ago. Along with his gospel that there was no real race problem, Dr. Washington promulgated another race philosophy. The world will pity a weak race, but it will not invest in one, he said. And we need investment now more than we need pity. White people may need their pity for the Negro, but the Negro does not need it. We must not emphasize, he said, the wrongs which we fancy we have suffered. Who among you would put your money into a bank if the banker advertised that every other bank was oppressing him? Who would risk his deposit in that bank if its president proclaimed that it was about to go down? Who among you would buy a horse if its owner rode up and down the country commenting upon the mistreatment which this animal had received? Let us emphasize, he said, the character of service, which we do. One of the most famous of his eloquent utterances was that in which he fancied a recreation. If the great Jehovah might allow him to re-enter that spirit world and give him the option of new citizenship, he said he would ask the Creator to make me an American Negro, the man with the greatest opportunity, he declared. And that opportunity he found in his native South. In his address in March 1907 to the faculty and members of the Theological Department of Vanderbilt University, he said, I was born a slave. I was born here in the South, and I am proud that I have always lived in the South. By the grace of God, I intend always to live here and teach my children to live here. And right here in the heart of the South, I hope to be buried. And he added, Now if in my talk this afternoon I seem to omit the duty which the Negro owes to himself and to you in the working out of problems to which reference has been made, I hope you will bear in mind that when I am speaking to my own people, I speak frankly and plainly and pointedly concerning their duty to you. There is quite a difference, however, between speaking to a people and about a people. Dr. Washington disliked heartily to be cast into the role of beggar for his people. He regarded them too highly to make them the object of perpetual almsgiving. The first big gift which he received, he tells in his book Up from Slavery, came from a Stanford, Connecticut capitalist. After having spent what the teacher regarded as 3 very unfruitful hours with his benefactor, Dr. Washington walked 4 miles in snow and rain to meet a man who showed not the slightest sign of any philanthropic purpose. 2 years later, in a very great emergency for Tuskegee, Dr. Washington received from this unemotional man $10,000. The businesslike method of presenting the Negro had won the Connecticut man. The same thing must have worked at home. All Southerners, he said, had decided by 1907 that somebody would educate the Negro. Since this is true, he continued, I believe that it is vastly better for all concerned for the Negro to be educated by the South, so that he will keep in touch with the conditions and opportunities which prevail in the South, so that he will always feel a sense of gratitude for the education of his children to the southern white man who is right at his door. I believe that the South in the main, he said, should win credit for the education of the Negro. He uttered the truism that low economic standards, disease, and crime, wherever they exist, will be reflected in all portions of the country. It was in character for Booker Washington, in an address before the New York City Republican Club on Abraham Lincoln Day in 1909, to tell them that it required as high a degree of courage for men of the type of Robert E. Lee and John B. Gordon to accept the results of the war in the manner and spirit which they did as that which Grant and Sherman displayed in fighting the physical battles that saved the Union. There he complained that the Negro had been too highly esteemed. There is much talk sometime about the inferiority of the Negro, he said. In practice, however, the idea appears to be that he is a sort of superman. He is expected, with about one-fifth of what the whites receive for their education, to make as much progress as they are making, he declared. He highly regarded his people, but he never thought them quite as good as that. I am happy today to join with you in honoring this great American, Booker T. Washington, in whom race and color were mere incidents. He was proud to be a Negro and prouder still to be an American. In him were incarnate the American qualities of buoyancy, the American wit, and the American open-faced good nature. He had the American optimism and the American faith in the future. He saw farm tenants, the heavily overworked washerwomen, the tragically underpaid day laborer, all at their worst. But he saw hope in all of them and helped them to plan the miracles which those hopes wrought. This was American democracy, producing American opportunity. His heroes, food, traditions, music, and religion, all were American, and he asked of his countrymen to have faith in the Negro, as the Negro has faith in America.